seeing U.S. aid disappear into the hands of those who were not the intended recipients.
All right. Thank you very much for that. We do appreciate your comments. John Pfeffer there, Director of the Foreign Policy and Focus, is talking to us there from Northampton, Massachusetts. Unfortunately, James Dutross, former U.S. diplomat from Virginia, we could not reestablish a connection with him. We do apologize for that. And that does it for this edition of The Spotlight. For me, Gabi Tagwe, and the team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Parhiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of the grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every ear. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Political stalemate throws Iraq into a bloody turmoil after supporters of the Saad movement stormed the government palace, prompting a nationwide curfew. Syria says the costs inflicted by US occupation forces and the terrorist groups under their backing now exceed $100 billion. And millions are in need of urgent aid as one-third of Pakistan remains underwater following devastating floods. Thank you for joining us. Top story this hour, Iraq is once again in the grip of worsening political turmoil. Deadly clashes have erupted in the capital, Baghdad, after cleric Muqtada al-Sadr announced he is withdrawing from politics. At least 20 people are killed and dozens more injured in clashes after Saad's supporters broke into Baghdad's Green Zone, which houses government buildings and embassies. They also stormed the presidential palace. Security forces fired tear gas and live rounds to disperse the crowd and took control of the palace where the government is seated. The unrest is prompted Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kazemi to suspend cabinet sessions until further notice. Iraq's Joint Operations Command has imposed a nationwide curfew and urged protesters to leave the Green Zone. Government offices are closed due to the curfew. Earlier on Monday, Saad said he is quitting politics in response to a prolonged political deadlock.
I decided to withdraw from the political process so as not to be involved with the corrupt politicians, neither in this world nor the hereafter.
Sadr also slammed other political leaders for not heeding to his calls for reform. He did not elaborate on the closure of his offices, but said some of his cultural and religious institutions would remain open. Iraq's state media say Sadr has gone on a hunger strike in protest against the use of force against his supporters. Last month, his supporters stormed parliament twice and later launched a sit-in outside the Supreme Judicial Council to step up pressure on it and dissolve the legislature. Iraq has been without a government or a head of state for months. Last parliamentary election saw an alliance led by Sadr win most seats, but he failed to form a government. Ottawa-based rights activist Firas al-Najim joined us earlier to tell us about the chain of events that led to the present political turmoil in Iraq.
This is a very difficult situation and timing for the Iraqi people because they have been through so many turbulences and developments and changes, and especially, the last, occupation of Iraq by the U.S. And then after that, you know, you had a big problem of chaos, and they tried to ignite, obviously, the American sectarian battles and cause problems between the Iraqis and cause more divisions. And then after that development, things kind of calmed down a little bit. And then after that, they, you know, the U.S. and their allies supported ISIS and then controlled a lot of areas. And then there was a big battle going on there. And Muqtada and his followers were part of the popular mobilization forces. At that time, you know, it was of great service, I can say, that Muqtada Sadr did serve the Iraqi nation at that time. During his political process, unfortunately, he's made very unstable moves and moves that were not calculated many times. And this led to many problems inside Iraq. And also at certain times, he supported the wrong side, when he should have been always allied with his real allies. And that is obviously the Islamic Republic of Iran and the Axis of Resistance. Just recently, you can see that he's not very stable person. I mean, look at what he did. He tried to put a government and form a government together. He got a majority with him, and he called for a majority government. And then after that, he pulls out of the parliament. And then all of a sudden, he tells his followers to go inside the parliament and take it over. You know what I mean? Remind me of how Trump did the same thing, when he didn't get the results that he wanted.
U.S. troops have been occupying parts of Syria for years now. The illegal presence has hindered the Syrian government's access to its badly needed oil resources. Now, Damascus says the losses inflicted by the occupying U.S. forces as well as terrorists have topped a whopping $100 billion. We discussed the issue in our news review program. Let's take a listen.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the News Review Program. Syria says that U.S. terrorists and separatists have costed over $107 billion in losses in oil, gas, and mineral sectors since 2011. The Syrian Foreign Ministry made the announcement in separate letters to the Secretary General of the United Nations and the President of the Security Council. It said terrorist groups and separatist Kurdish forces in northeastern Syria are looting, smuggling, and illegally trading the country's resources. Ministry stressed such violations are committed under the protection and with the support of U.S. forces illegally present in Syria. It said the so-called international coalition led by the U.S. has also been carrying out bombings and aggression on Syrian oil and gas facilities. It said Syria's oil, gas, and minerals production has also plummeted due to such hostile actions. The ministry called on the UN to deal with the humanitarian and economic situation in Syria with more seriousness and efficiency. And now joining us for this news review program is Tony Gosling, historian, investigative journalist, and former BBC employee joining us from London, and Mike Harris, finance editor at Veterans Today, joining us out of Portland, Oregon. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program here. I guess we'll start there in the U.S. with you, Mr. Mike Harris. Great to have you. I haven't spoken to you in a while. Hope you're safe and doing well out there in Portland. And now, Mike, we have, I got a little quote here by Jimmy Carter. It says, This is from January 23rd of 1980. He said, "Let our position be absolutely clear. An attempt by any outside force to gain control of the Persian Gulf region will be regarded as an assault on the vital interests of the United States of America, and such an assault will be repelled by any means necessary, including military force." Obviously, when it comes to the Middle East, we know that oil is a big issue with the U.S., and we know that humanitarian issues and human rights and all that good stuff just sounds great in boardrooms and in front of parliament members and Congress. But we know why the U.S. is really out here. Your initial thoughts on the story there, Bud.
My thoughts on this, and you know, my personal experience in Syria in 2014, 15, and 16, has been that the U.S. Is sponsoring terrorist groups for the explicit purpose of looting the mineral wealth and the petroleum wealth of not just Syria but the entire Persian Gulf. That's what's been going on there for some time, and it's outright looting. One thing I want to point out to the listeners is that this terrorism that is going on in Syria and the looting of the oil, this is a major criminal enterprise. The oil does not transport itself to the refinery. It has to be moved there by truck, by pipeline, by very large crude carrier ship. Something is moving it there. So that is one aspect of the criminality that's going on. The other aspect is the refinery has to know where this is coming from. So they know they're buying purloined goods. They know they're buying stolen oil. They know they're supporting terrorism. And the third point on this is that the banks who are clearing the transactions must know that the people who are selling the oil, who are being paid by the refineries, are also terrorists. So it gives you an inkling as to how huge this organized crime is that's looting Syria. This is not some small thing. This is not merely a few thousand jihadis in the field. This is truly a globalist criminal enterprise that is looting Syria for the purpose of supporting their own interests. They've lost their revenue stream out of Afghanistan when the heroin went away because the Taliban has eliminated 97% of heroin production, so they have to make up for it. So they're looting Syria, and that's what the purpose of this is to take wealth to support the criminal enterprises. Without money, they cannot bribe, they cannot blackmail, they cannot murder. They have to have money to pay their criminal counterparts. Otherwise, their jobs do not get done.
Thank you there, Mike. And Tony, I'd like to welcome you to the program here. Tony Gosling there, joining us out of Bristol, or London, it says here. Now, Tony, I like to Mike's point, I like he used globalist criminal enterprise, but according to, you know, heads in Washington, London, and whatnot, we heard a lot of, we have to get Bashar al-Assad out of the way. He's horrible for the people of Syria. What? So is this good for the people of Syria, looting basically any form of revenue that the country has?
Well, no, it's a war which is continuing to be waged by the West on Syria. And this is a proxy war. It's not, I think, for most people that have looked into this in any way, including those in the English language that read publications like the Middle East Monitor and Middle East Eye, because that, you know, there are publications in this part of the world that do look at these issues. This proxy war is just simply carrying on. The other aspect of all of this is that these energy wars, which effectively are a form of economic warfare, the idea is that, you know, you can wage war in a country like with cyber warfare without actually necessarily killing their people. What they've done, and I can remember back in the 1990 covering actually for the BBC the first Gulf War, and we were told that it's so sad that the Kurdish people are kind of caught in the middle here. And what's happening is there's a genuine grievance by the Kurds, which is being exploited by the West here, and extremely aggressive tactics towards them, of course, by the Turks. And the fact that they're stateless is being exploited by the West to be a thorn in the side, both financially and militarily, and the continued assault on Syria, this proxy war, which was started by the West, really as part of the Israeli Yinon plan to balkanize the Middle East, to break up the borders, to make porous borders. And this has provided a fantastic opportunity for organized crime with the protection of NATO to move into the region. But I noticed, amazingly, here in Britain, we've got quite a lot of support for the Kurds. I think this is by way of, creating little groups which are saying, oh, Kurdish freedom is so important. So, for example, in Somerset here in England, just this coming week, we've got workshops, for example, the Revolution Against Turkish Fascism workshop, another one, the Kurdistan Freedom Movement workshop. This is by this environmental group, Earth First, at their gathering. I'm not saying they support the looting of this oil by NATO, but what's happened here is a genuine grievance by the Kurds is being exploited in order to continue the war in the Middle East. And if you're looking at who's doing this, who's planning this, all you need to do is look at MacDill Air Force Base in Florida, which is what's called CENTCOM, their headquarters. And this is the arrogance of the United States. And of course, I don't excuse Britain, because we just do what the Americans tell us to do, in having this unified command structure for the whole world. And that's what my colleague there was talking about, the globalists. In the United States, there is a military operation to take over the world. No part of the world is free of these unified command structures. Every part of the world, including China, Russia, Australasia, has got an American command headquarters dedicated to controlling what happens in that part of the area and pushing US intelligence and military might in that part of the world. And I think the sooner that the unified command structure in the United States is shut down, the better. Unfortunately, though, many of the decisions which are made in US politics seem to be nothing whatsoever to do with what happens in the big wide world. They're all to do with impressing various voters in domestic politics. So the rest of the world, I think we need to put pressure on the Americans to say, look, mind your own business and get your military fingers out of all these pies. And it's not just, obviously, the Middle East. It's also the Asia too, where the Americans have been interfering, particularly with China.
Thank you both, Mr. Tony Gosling there joining us from London, and Mike Harris joining us out of Portland. And thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Okay, moving on. Russia has once again condemned Israel for continuing its airstrikes against Syria. The Russian ambassador to the United Nations said Israel has carried out hundreds of air raids on Syria in the last few years. Vasily Nebenzia underlined that such attacks completely violate the sovereignty and territorial integrity of the Arab country. The Russian diplomat also accused Washington of coordinating with Tel Aviv on the attacks. Citing a June airstrike on Damascus International Airport, Nebenzia said Israel received tactic approval from the U.S. He stressed that the airstrikes are a reflection of West's double standards toward the basic principles of international law and human rights. Since 2011, Israel has frequently pounded Syria with missiles. Damascus is critical of the international community's silence towards Israeli aggression. Calls are growing for the release of a Palestinian inmate who is in a critical health due to months-long hunger strike in a Israeli jail. A European Union delegation to Palestine has expressed shock at images of Khalil Awada shared by his wife and demanded that he should be freed immediately. In a tweet, the delegation said Awada is in imminent danger of dying. The 40-year-old has been refusing food since March in protest at his detention without charge by Israel. Doctors have already warned he is at risk of losing his life since he is suffering from a serious weight loss. Awada himself said in a message that his weak body represents the real face of the Israeli occupation. The Palestinian inmate has been arrested 5 times since 2005 for political activism and has been placed under the so-called administrative detention 3 times ever since. Over 680 Palestinians are being held by Israel without charge or trial. Moving on, US President Joe Biden is reportedly planning to get a congressional approval to supply Taiwan with arms worth over $1 billion. A US media report says the weapons would include 60 anti-ship missiles as well as 100 air-to-air missiles. The White House has not yet commented on the report package, but will need an approval from committees on foreign relations. Biden's plan comes amid heightened tensions with China. The two big economies have been on collision course ever since a controversial visit by U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to Taiwan earlier this month. China reacted to Pelosi's trip by conducting unprecedented military drills near the island. Tensions escalated further after more American politicians landed there. Beijing considers Taiwan as part of its territory. It has repeatedly warned Washington against its growing diplomatic relations with the island. Well, those were the top stories. Thank you for choosing us.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it. And leave no grief unless Thou takes it away. And leave no enemy. And leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger, and I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee,
O patron of beneficence.
The Limelight.
According to Child Poverty Action Group, already 800,000 children living in poverty in England do not qualify for free school meals. And now head teachers are bracing for rising numbers from homes that cannot afford to feed them properly. We have prepared for you an article written by Anna Fazakerly. The piece is titled Fears of Widespread Child Hunger Spark Calls for Universal Free School Meals in UK. Hunger will be the biggest single challenge UK schools face as children return to classrooms in the coming weeks, sparking calls for the government to introduce universal free school meals to help tackle the crisis. According to Child Poverty Action Group, already 800,000 children living in poverty in England do not qualify for free school meals. And now head teachers are bracing for rising numbers from homes that cannot afford to feed them properly. Paul Gosling, head of Exeter Road Community Primary School in Exmouth, in Devon, said, "Last winter, I already had a group of children who stood around the radiator outside my office every morning because they had no heating on at home and needed to warm up." He added, "We will have far more children turning up to school hungry." Paul Gosling, who is president of the National Association of Head Teachers Union, said his school was worrying about how to afford to keep the lights on, let alone helping families, but claimed he would not let any child stay hungry. Johnny Utley, the chief executive officer of the Education Alliance Academy Trust, which runs 7 schools in Hull and East Riding, said, "This food poverty is the single biggest challenge schools will face. More and more children will turn up to school hungry. It will go well beyond the definition of free school meals now." He added that even before the horrific energy cap crisis, he was planning measures such as breakfast clubs and uniform vouchers because of rising poverty in his schools. But now the potential scale of the problem is so much worse. In England, all infant school children are entitled to free school meals from reception to year 2. But beyond that, only children whose parents earn less than £7,400 a year are eligible. But the rise in the price cap for the average gas and electricity bill to £3,549 a year from October will mean many who earn more than this amount will face a stark choice between food and heating. It took a campaign by Manchester United and England footballer Marcus Rashford to force Prime Minister Boris Johnson into a U-turn on extending free school meals to the lowest income families during school holidays in November of 2020. The reversal came after a storm of criticism from charities, the opposition and media from both sides of the political divide. This summer, the British government again funded local authorities to offer eligible children a free meal a day and free activities under its holiday activities and food programme. But Labour Party has slammed this for being a part-time initiative that operates just 4 days a week for 4 weeks during the summer holiday, leaving children hungry for the rest of the time. Charities are angry that the threshold for free school meals has not changed since 2018, despite soaring inflation. Johnny Utley, the CEO of Education Alliance Academy Trust, believes the government needs to introduce universal free school meals because so many families will be in desperate need despite falling outside of the government's poverty threshold. He claimed the government did an extraordinary thing with furlough in the pandemic because it had to. It is difficult to see that child hunger isn't as important as that and doesn't require as radical a level of thinking. Richard Murphy, economic justice campaigner and professor of accounting at Sheffield University, said free school meals for all children in state schools was the only possible solution. He said, "Within months, we will be facing the worst economic crisis that anyone alive has witnessed," adding, "The government must move rapidly and universally, as the cost of not doing so is not just child poverty, but child hunger, and that cannot be acceptable." The Welsh Government has committed to rolling out free school meals for all primary school children by 2024, and ministers have said they will try to bring this forward. Ahead of the last Holyrood election, the Scottish National Party pledged to provide a free breakfast and lunch to all primary age children by August of this year, although this has not yet been achieved. A single mother in Tyne and Wear who spoke to The Observer under condition of anonymity said that although she is on universal credit and frightened about juggling food and bills this winter, her two sons are not entitled to free school meals at their primary school because she earns £728 a month working part-time in education administration. She said, "We already have thermals and fleece pyjamas so we can avoid putting the heating on in our home. The kids have free swimming lessons, which we have factored in as a hair washing day to avoid running a bath at home." She said, "The cap for free school meals is far too low," adding, "Apparently, we're poor, but not poor enough." Andy Jolly, a former school governor and campaigner for free school meals, said, "It's incredibly difficult to become eligible for free school meals. A lot of people who have lost their jobs, who you would have imagined must be eligible, just aren't." He added, "Registration isn't automatic. Parents have to tell the school and then go through a complicated process to apply. Often because of barriers such as language or fear of stigma, families don't claim." A spokesperson for the Department of Education said, "More than 2,000 schools are currently signed up to the National School Breakfast Programme, claiming, we're investing up to £24 million in the programme and expanded eligibility in January to reach more schools in disadvantaged areas." The spokesperson said, "We're also providing 1.9 million children with free school meals, as well as welfare support for families in need through the Household Support Fund." Moreover, the United Nations has said the number of people going hungry in the world has risen by 115 million people since the start of the COVID pandemic, warning that the food crisis sparked by Russia-Ukraine conflict risks pushing the worst-hit countries into famine. A report has found globally the number suffering from chronic undernourishment rose to as many as 828 million last year, a rise of about 46 million under previous year, and three times that increase if measured since the world shut down due to the COVID pandemic. With the price of fuel, food staples and fertilizers soaring since the Russia's special operation in Ukraine, however, the total is expected to rise even further in the next year, a scenario that could see some of the world's poorest fall into famine, the most extreme form of food deprivation. Due to the uncertainty caused by the lingering impact of COVID shutdowns, the report released recently is unable to give a precise figure for the number of people going hungry in 2022. instead estimating that the total was somewhere between 702 million and 828 million. The report said an estimated 45 million children under the age of 5 were suffering from wasting, the deadliest form of malnutrition, which increases children's risk of death by up to 12 times. About 149 million children under the age of 5 had stunted growth and development due to a chronic lack of essential nutrients.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Declassified. Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and welcome to the latest edition of Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. We'll be looking into the role of the Jewish National Fund today, often referred to as the JNF. It's a key agency that's responsible for stealing Palestinian land and for the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people. The JNF is an integral part of the Zionist regime, but it also has an influential presence in the UK. I'm going to be talking to experts about the JNF's activities after this investigative report by Bianca Rahimi, examining precisely how the Jewish National Fund is engaged in ethnic cleansing.
The Jewish National Fund was a key land-seizing mechanism of the Zionist movement. Founded in 1901, it features heavily in most accounts of ethnic cleansing prior to the Nakba of 1948. However, post-foundation of the temporary entity, it has enjoyed a special status as an untouchable claw of Zionist enterprise. Today, the JNF is an instrument through which Israel is able to deny international accountability. The Jewish National Fund is a parastatal body which manages to wield some of the powers of a state without being restricted by any of the responsibilities of a state, according to international law. It enabled Israel to bypass UN Resolution 194 and block Palestinian right of return by asserting that the land was owned now by the JNF, a supposedly private body which is not subject to international law. It also allows Israel today to keep a quasi-arm's-length relationship with the colonization of Palestinian territories and evade scrutiny. The relationship between the JNF and the temporary entity is clear, with a major overlap of board members between the Israel Land Authority and the JNF. The JNF is also deeply intertwined with the Israeli military.
Thank you for helping bring all of us together to serve our beloved Israel and the IDF. It is a privilege for Israelis to defend and protect our country. Special Uniform makes it possible for all of us to proudly fulfill our commitment to serve Eretz Israel. With your contribution to Special Uniform through the Jewish National Fund, you've changed their lives, their families' lives, and so many of our special citizens' lives.
JNF UK functions in Britain as a charity, despite its action clearly being incongruent with the requirement of fulfilling a social good. It has well-documented involvement with both illegal settlement building and militarism in Palestine. The UK branch of the JNF supports numerous Israeli military academies. Derech Eretz, Neve Otzim, In Prat or Mi Ofer, Nachson, Mitarim Lachishand and Hashomer HaChadash. These institutions provide military training and act as a gateway directly into the Israeli army. JNF UK was inspected by the UK Charity Commission in 2005. The Charity Commission stated it is not open for the charity to support Israel since this does not itself denote a charitable purpose. The inspection report went on to recommend action in the following way. They should try to ensure that they refrain from indicating moral or political support of Israel, rather explain the focus of their charitable activities.
Former senior vice president of the Board of Deputies, Gary Mond, recently resigned from his position after it came to light he had posted Islamophobic ideas online, notably that civilization was at war with Islam. He was simultaneously the honorary treasurer at the JNF UK and has retained his position there. JNF UK chair and former Israeli intelligence officer Samuel Hayek was also found to have made Islamophobic remarks. Other Jewish groups and even Israel lobby group, the Board of Deputies, spoke out against him. On the 13th of January, the UK Charity Commission opened an investigation into the JNF UK to assess the situation.
Obviously, the JNF UK did not stop acting as a settlement-building, militaristic lobby group which promotes a hostile foreign power. It just became further entrenched in British society, adding to its list of patrons former British Prime Ministers Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, who share their patron status at the JNF UK with the current Prime Minister and President of the apartheid entity.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. He's also a co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch. We're also joined today by Fatih Nimmer. He's a political scientist, an activist, and he's also a former teaching fellow at the Democracy and Human Rights Programme at Birzeit University. And he's a co-founder of the Decolonised Palestine website, which is well worth checking out. We recorded Fatih's comments earlier. Welcome to the show. Now, I asked Fatih to tell us about the origins of the JNF.
Well, the Jewish National Fund was founded in the very early 1900s as an arm of the Zionist colonization of Palestine. Its main role was to acquire lands and to help with settling as many Jewish settlers, Zionist Jewish settlers in the lands as possible. And to those ends, it basically subsidized the whole colonization of Palestine through those means, because the farmers in those days could not at all subside without direct support from abroad. So its goal was to basically bring this land and put it into Jewish hands. That's their mandate until this very day. And they did a job of purchasing lands, acquiring lands through other means, and keeping them only for Zionist uses.
I also asked him about the JNF role in the Nakba.
The JNF's role during the Nakba was as the entirety of the Zionist entity at the time. It was all a complicated, basically, network of all of them working together towards the aim of ridding Palestine of as many Palestinians as possible. And after the Zionist forces would destroy a village, for example, the JNF would come in and they would plant trees on top of the villages to completely erase the Palestinians from the area. They would take all of these areas and they would build entire nature parks to erase clusters. And these nature parks would, of course, be planted with European trees, to the point where some of these areas are called like Little Switzerland and other areas, because this is where the Zionists came from. Like the earlier Zionists were come from Eastern Europe and Central Europe, and they came and they wanted to basically create a European colony in Palestine. So during the Nakba and until this day, the JNF plays a huge role in
basically greenwashing and giving a light of legitimacy for the destruction of Palestinian villages and the erasure of Palestinian identity, the erasure of Palestinian, you know, existence in this land. It goes hand in hand with the military, goes hand in hand with all kinds of political and economic decisions, and it plays a very big role with that until this day.
David, I wonder if come to you then. I mean, the JNF's website says that it collaborates with elite IDF units on projects. I mean, how does it maintain its fluffy veneer?
It's extraordinary, isn't it? This is an organisation which in this country is regarded as being a little bit controversial by some people, but it has a sort of under-the-radar quality. It's an organisation engaged in conspicuous human rights abuses and land theft and ethnic cleansing, and as you say, is collaborating with the IDF. Now, that there should be no place for an organisation like this in the UK. It's a charity, it has charitable functions, it's supposed to perform public benefit. Now, it's not clear to me how collaboration with the IDF could be any sort of public benefit, but nevertheless, it has gone through previous Charity Commission inquiries and has not been closed down, stretching back many, many years, actually. So there's a real question here for me about why it is that organisations like this are able to carry on in breach of what would appear to be their charitable objectives and functioning as if they're normal charities when they're in no way normal charities. They're engaged in activities in occupied Palestine which breach international law, which breach human rights legislation, and which, for any conscience, any person of conscience, should be completely unacceptable.
Mm. Well, I mean, we also asked Fatih, or should I say Fatih told us about the JNF and how it provides a form of legal protection for the apartheid.
The thing about the Israeli tactics when it comes to its propaganda about how it has, you know, equality for all citizenship is that it has these little technicalities and loopholes, and the JNF participates very willingly in this. For example, when we're talking about, they say all of our citizens are equal, but they don't mention that nationality determines your national rights, and nationalities are not equal in Israel. Similarly, the JNF controls huge areas of land inside the Green Line, and it only allows the use of these lands for Jewish uses. So basically, if you're not Jewish, you're not allowed to use these lands. It's estimated actually that around 80% of all the territory inside the Green Line or inside Israel is off limits if you're not Jewish. You can't lease it, you can't buy it. And this is through like technicalities and loopholes, whereas they say, well, there's no official ban on the purchase of these lands by non-Jewish citizens or so forth. But what happens is that there are these committees, and the JNF has a very important vote on who gets to use land, like state land, and who doesn't get to use state land.
I mean, David, the JNF was investigated by the Charity Commission in 2005, and a few actions were recommended. I mean, can you tell us a bit about that?
So, I mean, one of the things that the Charity Commission recommended to the JNF after it investigated was that it should be wary of seeming to promote Israel, and that instead it should focus on its more charitable objectives, which to do with land, etc., in Israel. Now, it hasn't done anything noticeable to carry out that requirement, and the Charity Commission has not done anything subsequently. It's very much a pro-Israel charity, and all of its directors and people who've been in directorial roles there, stretching back to 2005, have always been, you know, extreme pro-Israel partisans. So there's a real mismatch here between, you know, the actually sensible thing that the Charity Commission said, which was that they shouldn't be allowed to be promoting Israel, and the actual practice of the JNF, which to its very core is a pro-Israel organisation and continues to promote Israel, and whether it's right or wrong.
Mm. I mean, what involvement does the JNF UK have in so-called anti-racist groups in this country?
Well, the JNF UK is a series of different charities, and they operate under a number of different names. They've got a Scottish branch, etc. And so they do engage in fundraising activities where they bring in pro-Israel personalities, and famously in about 2005 they had Colin Powell, the former US Secretary of State, came to speak to them in Glasgow, and there was a big demonstration outside. Goldie Hawn, the actress, another one who came, and various other people have been to do fundraising for them. And that fundraising has gone off the boil since there have been so many protests about the kinds of things that they they do. Their involvement with anti-racist activity, well, it's not quite correct, is it? I mean, they've been involved in racist activity in this country. Two of them only recently involved in Islamophobic statements, asked to step down from various bodies. It really does illustrate the specific Zionist component of Islamophobia in this country. Really, the State of Israel has been promoting this idea that Muslims are particularly Islamophobic since about 1984 or so. I mean, way back in history, one of the very earliest interventions of Benjamin Netanyahu when he was the ambassador to the UN in the US. So they've been promoting this idea that Muslims are particularly Islamophobic. No empirical basis for it, but this shows you the activities with the GNF and the people there making these Islamophobic statements, that there is a specific Zionist component to Islamophobia, which helps to promote Islamophobia more widely on the far right and in other places as well. So, so the involvement of the GNF in these kind of politics is on the side specifically and only of the racists.
Yeah, I mean, what's its role with the campaign against anti-Semitism as well? And I think the chap called Gideon Falter. I mean, they've got some connection there, hasn't they?
Yes, this guy, Gideon Falter, was one of the early people who set up the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism, which campaigned, as you'll recall, against the Corbyn-led Labour Party, took a complaint to the Equalities and Human Rights Commission.
Yeah, Commission.
And Falter is also on the GNF, so there's a connection there.
Right.
But also, if you look very closely, and we've done this, at the accounts of the GNF, you'll see that there are transactions in there, third-party transactions, related party transactions, and that they show that most of the CAA's budget for a couple of years came directly from the GNF. So it's actually funding work which is supposed to be about tackling anti-Semitism, but which isn't, in reality, of course, about tackling those people who would be willing to stand up for Palestinian rights.
Sure. Well, let's just pause there for a moment, though, and have a look at this report on how the GNF uses environmentalism to deflect attention from its racist activities.
The JNF has always worked hand in glove with the Israeli apartheid entity and today is using environmentalism as a subterfuge for further ethnic cleansing. The director of the JNF's Land and Afforestation Department in 1948, Yosef Weiss, was simultaneously on the transfer committee for the first Israeli government, which oversaw the displacement of almost a million Palestinians. The JNF is hoping to fill Palestine's Mojave Desert with around 800,000 Jewish settlers. However, this will take many years, so in the meantime, the organization has planted a vast forest of 250 million trees.
Israel is planting trees, European trees, that have no connection to the land in the Bedouin land in order to take the land of the Bedouins. Israel is taking Palestinians off their land and putting trees in their place, and it's taking the trees of the Palestinians also. In the village of Al-Araqib that was demolished more than 250 times today, 4,000 trees, olive trees, were taken by the Israelis. The Israelis destroyed them, and in order to build a GNF forest, the body that and the organization that is doing crimes against the Bedouin Palestinians in Al-Naqab is called the GNF.
The JNF has brandished the justification of environmentalism, but this falls short when considering that they've used northern European pine trees, which easily catch fire in Palestine's scorching sun. The JNF has planted trees in the names of some of its supporters in the UK, from former Labour MP John Mann to LBC political editor Theo Usherwood. Edgar Davidson nominated trees to be planted in the name of famous British Islamophobes Tommy Robinson and Katie Hopkins for, quote, standing with the Jewish people and for exposing the lies spewed against Israel. Tommy Robinson's legal advisor, Robert Festenstein, is also president of the Zionist Central Council and represents Prestwick Hebrew Congregation on the Board of Deputies. Environmentalism as subterfuge for ethnic cleansing brings together some fascinating bedfellows.
Well, when we spoke to Fatih earlier, we asked him what the JNF's up to in the Naqab Desert right now.
The JNF, as usual, has been a very important part of Zionist settler colonialism in Palestine. And the new target for this area is now the Naqab Desert, which they try to, you know, frame as some kind of desolate backwards barrens that has never been taken care of. But actually, data shows that it was one of the most, you know, agriculturally used areas in the area. And as soon as the Palestinian Bedouins were ethnically cleansed from there, it stopped producing anything. So now they have these little oases that they, you know, try to show, look, Israelis made the desert bloom, but they actually made everything worse. So what they're doing right now, they're trying to say, oh, we're having these tree planting campaigns supported by the JNF, which they try to put forward as an ultimate good. Who could, you know, oppose planting trees? But the thing is, these are not, they're not planting trees for the sake of the environment. They're planting trees to take over more and more land, annexing more and more lands from the, you know, the indigenous Palestinian tribes that have always lived there for hundreds and hundreds of years. And they're taking over the land little by little, and they want to put them in these small little contained cities that they're building for them, away from their ancestral, you know, feeding grounds and all that. And the JNF is playing a leading role in that. They're the ones planting the trees. They're the ones planning parks to do over there. These are not kind neutral activities. All of these things are aimed to replace the indigenous population. This also happened in Turtle Island in North America. A lot of the natural reserves in the United States were created with the purpose to remove the indigenous tribes living there and the indigenous nations. It's settler colonialism learns from each other. And this is basically a kind of tactic that all settler colonies have been using. And the JNF is an expert at this point in it.
David, I've come to you now. I mean, what's the involvement of British celebrities and media figures in this tree planting nonsense?
Well, it's extraordinary, isn't it? People who are, especially people who've been at the forefront of the so-called campaign against anti-Semitism in this country, in the UK, over the last 5 to 7 years, who have said that what they're doing is nothing to do with Israel, it's only to do with protecting Jews who are subject to racial hatred and all that kind of thing, which, I mean, most of which, of course, they've made up. But nevertheless, let's take that at face value. But when you look at this tree planting thing, you see they come out from underneath their defence of, we're only targeting anti-Semitism, to see that they're actually paid-up supporters of ethnic cleansing and indeed of racism, the racism and ethnic cleansing of the JNF. So there are people in there whose names are listed there who have been central to the campaign against the Corbyn-led Labour Party, for example, and there are also celebrities. I noticed the actor Eddie Marson's in there, and it was J.K. Rowling. The author is in there, and these are people who are not just there to defend Jews against anti-Semitism, as perhaps they sometimes say, they're also there to defend the ethnic cleansing and the racism of the JNF.
Yes, and sort of engage in propagandising. Well, look, I mean, we also asked Fatih about what he made of the JNF's claims about environmentalism.
Once again, there's no actual environmental message in what the JNF does. It plays a big part in their propaganda that they're making the desert green. They're trying to, you know, dry all the swamps and all that. But what has actually led to? It's led to ecological disasters. All of these trees that they plant, because at the end of the day, the Zionist leadership in origin were Central and Eastern Europeans, and they want Central and Eastern European trees. And this is the kind of trees that they brought with them. They grow these trees, and they're surprised every few years when there's a giant fire that, you know, burns down half the country inside there, because they want to live in Switzerland in the Middle East. And that's just not how, you know, the environment works.
David, I understand that the JNF UK is also currently under investigation by the Charity Commission for Islamophobia. I mean, can you give our viewers the benefit of a bit more background information about that?
So, yes, there were two incidents at the end of 2021 and the beginning of 2022. One, the guy in charge of the JNF, a guy called Samuel Hayek, who's not British, by the way, he's Israeli, and he's lived in Britain for some decades. He's a former Israeli military intelligence officer, in case you didn't know. And he made some statements which were widely criticised, including by some liberal Zionist groups, as being Islamophobic, and was forced to step down. And then... Quite soon thereafter, another person who was on the JNF's board and who's also on the board of deputies, a guy called Gary Mond, some of his Islamophobic posts were revealed, and he was called on to step down from the board and I think did, but hasn't stepped down from the JNF. But nevertheless, as a result of these two quite, you know, quite serious allegations of Islamophobia against these people in the JNF, the Charity Commission is currently investigating. Now, whether the Charity Commission will come up with anything sensible, whether there will be anything sensible at all in its report remains to be seen. I wouldn't hold my breath about that, because the Charity Commission has shown that it's quite keen not to properly investigate Zionist charities, whereas it is very keen to investigate Muslim charities and to try and have them shut down. Indeed, there's a whole history going back to 9/11 of the Charity Commission investigating Muslim charities, quite a number of them, at the behest directly of the State of Israel. So you can see there's an imbalance there. But if they were to take a proper approach to this, they were to properly investigate the JNF, what you would find is that there's a breach of charitable objectives, and that much of the activities carried out by the JNF, and indeed many other Zionist charities, are way beyond what they say they're doing in their charitable objectives. And they're, of course, supporting illegal settlements, ethnic cleansing, and the theft of land in Palestine. And they should have no place as charities in this country. So I hope that a properly constituted Charity Commission investigation would find that kind of thing.
I mean, and just say a little bit more as well about the campaign against the JNF, particularly in Scotland, because I think there's quite an active campaign going on there, isn't there?
So, yes, I mean, Stop the JNF is an international campaign, but there have been chapters of it in various different countries, and Scotland's been particularly active. I mean, there was for 25 years an annual JNF Scotland golf competition.
Yes, indeed, right? I'm familiar with that. Yeah.
Which the Scottish Palestine Solidarity people who were involved in Stop the JNF went along and tramped around the Glasgow golf course on the outskirts of Glasgow and had it stopped, and it's not going on anymore. And also, of course, they used to have these fundraising dinners in the centre of Glasgow in a plush hotel right beside the M8 motorway, and that's where Colin Powell was demonstrated against, and indeed, Goldie Hawn and others. And these have been much more difficult to put on now that more and more people are coming to realise what the JNF is about and how it's involved with ethnic cleansing.
Yeah. Well, thanks very much indeed for that. Fortunately, we're out of time. I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there now. Thanks indeed. We'll be back next week with more investigation and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So, until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.